When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You have to work from your head, your heart, and your guts. And they each could tell a different story.
That's
right. And you're sitting there, you know, behind the big desk with your head, your heart, your guts out there telling you shit. And, you know, the barking their response. You have to figure out what's common to this. The director, at his best, takes all these things into account, makes one call.
Yeah.
It's kind of zen. Just makes one call, and it's the perfect glue between these different disciplines. So that's what I've been trying to do,
is
to find that center point. Yeah, balance.
It's a moving target, that balance. Art in itself is just full of so many contradicting forces at once. But the magic of the recording is a new day every single time, right? I mean,
every time, yeah. And it should be. And it's when it isn't that you're in trouble.
Hi, if you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot. Hello and welcome to the podcast, Lightning Bugs, with me, Ben Folds. It's Thursday, which means it's George Massenburg Day. Every day from here on will be George Massenburg Day. Why? Because the son of a bitch invented the parametric EQ when he's 23 years old. That's why. Today, we have that great George Massenburg on our podcast. He's a Grammy Award-winning recording engineer, too many to count, producer, inventor, designer, and now educator. He's participated in over 400 records over the past 45 years, including recordings of Earth, Wind, and Fire, which is burned into my brain. Billy Joel, Journey, some music you can't unhear, Mary Chapin Carpenter, and many more. George has also designed, built, and managed several recording studios. I visited him one time in Blackbird, where he had designed a room that he called the Integer. It looks like he threw spears through the wall, and the whole room is just full of all these encroaching, random-sized pieces of wood, which we call diffusion, which ironically make something that he calls a diffusionless room, but you'll have to talk to George about that. In 1982, he founded George Massenburg Labs. If you've used his parametric EQ, it's to die for. A pioneering audio electronics company that has released an extensive range of innovative recording technologies, all based on his original designs. We really got into the nitty-gritty about audio engineering. I say nitty-gritty. If it was really nitty-gritty, we'd all be lost. This man knows more about audio engineering and sound than anyone I have ever met, probably anyone you will ever meet. And he's also a great fellow. Hope you have as much fun as I did. Here's my conversation with George fucking Massenburg. How's it going?
It's so good to see you.
Good to see you too. You look great. Check you out. I think it's only been like 10 years since the last recent time we caught up.
No. When you came to the hotel, you came to...
It was five. Four.
Yeah. And we drank tequila all afternoon. I'll never forget it. It's a high point.
You know, I used to move my own piano, and the guy who taught me how to move the piano was a piano tech named James Arledge. Do you happen to know James?
I can't say as I do.
So he pretty much makes the best strings for pianos, but he started off in the Charlie Daniels band, and then he was my piano tuner before I was actually making records, and he taught me how to move the piano. One day I had a big cup of water right there on the piano, and I basically dumped it fully into the pin block, which you might know that's death for a piano.
That's death for a piano because you can't dry it fast enough.
No, do anything you want to the rest of the piano. The pin block is the thing that you
can't really replace. So I called James up in a panic. I was like, oh, I just put water in my piano, water in my pen block. And he goes, that's okay. Do this for me. Turn it upside down and rest it on a cinder block or something, anything that you can get to kind of put it upside down. I'll be there in 45 minutes. Have it, get as many hair dryers as you can, put them up underneath the piano, and I'll be there. I turned it upside down because I knew how to move the piano. I got hair dryers from neighbors, and I just put hair dryers on it. He came by, and it was fine. Another time, I dropped it off the truck. It fell off the back of the truck, and I called him in a titter that time, too. But that's, you know.
For the last year, it's been all about video. So it's been, for me, great. Because I've got budgets, and they'll let me try things that I could never try before because we don't have audiences. So I can put cameras where they belong in front of these singers. So, and really getting a good style of direction together for opera.
Wow,
so
for
opera? I'm pretty proud of them. For opera, we just did Turning of the Screw by Benjamin Britten, which you probably know. It's 12-tone, but boy, it's just great.
He's accessible even when he's gone off the deep end, though. Like
he's got a couple of singles in there.
Yeah, he always has hits. The hits kept coming for that guy. Absolutely. He said he wrote music for human beings. I always like that.
I love that.
You're digging this, I don't know, artistic control, or I don't know what you would call that.
I don't call it control, because the same thing I do in the studio is I make sure that someone who isn't deserving of control is a long way from the console.
Okay.
You know, labels, A&R people. And it's the same thing in video, is to keep those who aren't deeply invested in the art at arm's length. And our director of McGill Opera is brilliant, gets gigs everywhere. And we trust each other, and we have a way of communicating, you know, on lighting, which is just, I don't need to tell you, essential, and shots and drama, how to express acting in opera, because it's not park and bark anymore. It's getting close to the acting. I've done a fuck ton of interviews.
I know.
I'll try to keep the fucks to a minimum. But
no,
I've done a fuck ton
don't.
Of interviews. And this is about the best introduction, or the best entry into orbit for an interview I've seen so far, Ben. So,
oh, shit.
Well done.
Well, thank you. Done. Okay, well, let's see if nice. We can improve on it from here then. You know what my first question was? Was just going to be, what are you interested in at this moment? Like, what are you doing at this moment? It seems to be what you started talking about.
At this moment, we're investigating immersive. And we're not only investigating it at the school in an academic context with different arrangements of speakers and different presentations, but I'm mixing for an artist who I really, really like.
Oh, cool.
Alicia Keys.
Oh.
And I mixed her new thing in immersive. And then Eric Schilling and I have been mixing another record in immersive. And I've got a couple more, because as we go back in her career, we see slices of her interest build.
Oh.
And her songwriting, it's my style of songwriting, because it's great story and it's great poetry. And it's great phrasing. And she's the nicest person in the world, as are you. So, I mean, so if you ever are interested in doing immersive, I don't get paid for anything anymore, but that's okay. But I can show you some tricks to spark your imagination in immersive.
Here's the first thing. The first step towards immersive for me is going to be to know what it is. So that's my next question. What is immersive?
The basic definition, because there are different technical definitions, but the basic definition is you listen to sound, it seems to be coming from all around you.
Okay.
So think a cinema presentation in Dolby Atmos.
Okay.
We're working in Dolby Atmos in Sony 360 and a couple of discrete formats, but the idea is to have you immersed in not a literal context. I mean, it could be an artistic representation of a song. Uh-huh. But in classical music, it's very straight ahead. So it's a great concert hall that picks up movement. Think of an opera singer moving across the stage, okay, and having a real representation of the room in early reflections and in the ambience. You should be carried away so that you ignore the sound, okay, and are right, deeply connected to the performance. That's the way it should be.
So in essence, it's maybe a deeper way of thinking about surround. It's just surround, like
it is surround grown large.
Okay,
and
meaning
yeah, and
meaning
in fact,
more. I mean, you look like you're having a speaker sale behind you. That's all part of the rig.
I have a 714 system, so I have seven instead of five. They're sides. And the normal fronts and backs. But it's basically this 714 system. Dolby doesn't even support 714, so we have to fake it from a 712. But the basic idea is at least 712 or 714 with four speakers on top,
yeah,
two front, two back, seven around you, you know, in a sub that we don't use very much. Basically, the techniques are all evolved from our experience in 5-1 and trying to get 5-1 right. And most importantly, trying not to lose the groove of a great mix when we're remixing a record. And that's been a challenge with Alicia because that stuff is, you know, new R&B. And if it doesn't lock in, if it doesn't groove, you know, that's not the gig.
You've been interested in this for a long time. And you know, our sitting and talking about sound is a little bit like I'm the old man, and I've always been like, I just kind of like, look, I'm happy with all the speakers, but there's something that has always made me happy about one speaker too, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. And I remember when you set up that system in the old house in Nashville,
yeah,
right in the room, the addition, and how happy you were with that.
I was so thrilled with that. Yeah.
And you were playing records. I think you were playing.
Oh yeah,
playing
my records. House has always been a life support system for my turntable. But yeah.
So everything about what I've been doing has been trying to get back to that thrill, that magic of hearing this amazing thing move through wire. You know, this amazing emotion move through wire.
You've said two things there that really hit the center of my soul. One is the back to when I was a kid. There were little people in the speaker. I mean, that's, to me, that's what it was. Like, no one told me there was a crossover. There was no room. There was no anything. There were little people in the speaker.
It was magic.
Yeah. And it was also the miracle. When I was a kid, although electricity wasn't new, there was the sense that it had recently been new. There was the magic of the miracle of electricity flowed through the reproduction of a song. And I got that
still,
when I was 4 years old.
Still.
Yeah. I mean, I think
still,
getting back to it is the secret. And I think that what I love about your thinking and in your career is that for you, I don't feel like it's a return to anything. It's more of a everyday reminder, looking for the magic in that. A lot of us keep going back to vintage gear, for instance, like that they're like, okay, well, there was magic back when it was discovered. Maybe we need to throw away everything since then, go back to the magic old gear, and that's the way. But you have never been like that.
This thing is now going to be 40 years old in a minute.
That's
and
vintage
I'm still
gear.
Having I'm still, yeah, my EQ is vintage gear, but that's a pain in the ass to support. Parts go obsolete. Right now, I couldn't find a center tap pot. We've been out of business for a year and 2 months because I couldn't find a center tap pot to do the boost cut. Finally have one. That's what it's doing here is I'm calibrating this new pot. But I'm going to combine it all. I'm going to take the ability to speak. This is important. Because we couldn't speak to the world very effectively with vinyl. And we can speak to the world with digital. And if we can improve a digital or some kind of data connection and learn from our history and remembering that feeling, that's the important
yeah.
thing, is that thrill. Because if you don't get that thrill,
I know,
then it doesn't work and yeah. go back and do it again.
And now let's get some questions and comments.
Hey, Ben, my Hello? Question for you is, what is different about this project that your other projects don't have?
Yeah, I assume you're talking about the podcast. What's different about it? I don't know. I don't really. I assume that if I'm interested in something, that it is because there's something different. And sometimes I think I have to discover what that is. So I'll tell you that what I think that it is that I am listening to people, artists, creative thinkers. I'm listening to their point of view. I'm asking them questions rather than doing what I'm doing right now, which is answering questions. I've spent a life being the interviewee. So that's very different, that I'm extracting stuff out of other people. Fancy way to say I'm interviewing. But the reason that it's different, and I think it's different for me to be in the questioner's seat rather than the questioned, if that makes sense. Thanks for your question. Take care of yourself. Thank you.
I want to talk about Joseph Campbell and Hero of a Thousand Faces. And the idea of the dream of the young knight, mm-hmm. and about dreams in general, and about how dreams are common across cultures.
Yeah.
And you remember in Hero of a Thousand Faces that we met Joseph Campbell at Skywalker because he interviewed in George's library. In Hero of a Thousand Faces, he points to a common dream across cultures of the young warrior going out to conquer the dragon or going out to in conquest, except he can't find his sword and it's locked up in the cabinet and the key is under his mother's pillow. And it's a dream that's common to enough different cultures to be really spooky. So that idea of a dream of going out and conquering this almost impossible enterprise of making music more connected. And I can't find the key. So I'm still looking for the key.
My parents bought one musical instrument and it was for my father, who was a construction guy who had no music. He'd never thought about music, but his doctor said, you know, you need to relax some. You've got some stress issues here. Why don't you buy yourself a guitar and learn how to play guitar? They put it under the bed and I couldn't get to it. They were like, don't touch. So in a way, the guitar was always under my mother's pillow in a way. That's as close as I could come to.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Eventually, I did start to sneak in and I got to the guitar and I took a drumstick and I started playing all the strings with the drumstick, which of course.
Oh, cool.
Well, I thought it was cool. They didn't think it was cool when they saw the marks on the guitar. So,
my first gift from my father, I'm seven and I'm in Macon, Georgia. I got a soldering iron. That was my first gift from my father. And I would take apart stuff and you know, I had no idea what I was doing, but I had a soldering iron or a tool.
The difference between One difference between us, I think, is that in our trajectory is that I learned how I took things apart all the time. I would go to yard sales. I would get a radio. I take it apart. I get anything I could get. I took it apart. The drums were a particular pain in the ass for the whole family because I was always taking the drums. I don't know why. Apart. Where we veer is I never learned how to put them back together.
It's interesting you should mention that because since I had a soldering iron, my family would bring me their broken radios, assuming, oh, George, he'll fix it. Not very often, occasionally.
Yeah.
But, you know, you learn to keep that extra stash of screws and yep. nuts that were supposed to go back in. I'm sure.
Yeah, right up there. I've still,
And occasionally, I fixed a radio. And of course, then you're famous, and then everybody wants to give you a radio. So, Ben, are you taking pictures? What are you doing?
I'm actually not, almost at all. But, you know, since last time we were talking, and you were definitely getting way into video, and you're still there now, it sounds like. Have you gone as far down that wormhole or whatever in still photography, or did you just sort of jump straight to video?
I jumped straight to video. Moving moving back to understanding how shots are composed,
right,
and studying film, how frames are composed, how these directors work. And I know a couple of directors, and generally it's so second nature to them that they can't tell you how they see it. Mm-hmm. But the grips do. The guys that do the lighting.
Right.
We got this guy that we work with, Mikey Madison, who's gripped everything since the beginning of time. And he'll tell me about light. He'll tell me about the subtleties of light. And that's ever so informative.
Oh, yeah.
About paying attention to light, because it's all about light, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And so I'm regressing, in a sense, and rebuilding as much as I can, because, you know, I don't have any credentials in video, none, except that I'm going to do it and stay out of my fucking way. I mean,
awesome.
I'm sorry to put it that way.
No, I love that. That's real interest, though. I mean, that's I love that.
But it's about capturing an actor. It's about, an opera is not about close-ups. As I said, it's about park and bark, you know, and you get the whole line from 50 meters away. And we try to get action moving up from the actor's body and trying to write down in rehearsals where the actor is moving their hands interestingly and trying to get a little bit more than,
yes,
here it is.
Yeah.
Take it. You know, so I'm paying more attention. And it's good to pay attention. The new Blade Runner is pretty interesting. It doesn't have the magic of the first one, but the color is fabulous. Huh. The color work is fabulous. And I've been learning a lot about how to use DaVinci Resolve. And you would love this program because it's subtle and you can find all the right spots to color. And so that's taken a while to learn.
Mm.
So I'm learning how much, I'm finding out how much I don't know and just hoping I still have time to get it all right.
It's just having some idea of dynamic range.
Absolutely.
You can't tell a story in which the bottom and the top have been clipped out of the experience. And if you don't spread that correctly over it, then nothing means what it meant when you looked at it. And it's interpretation.
But I love this, the idea of doing what Ansel Adams used to do in a camera, being able to do that later in some form, and not the same thing, but in some form.
Acutance versus resolution. I don't get to all my questions.
Wow.
But I wanted to, because I knew you were into video, and I was like, you would either be okay with the comparison to Ansel Adams or not. Because people tend to have opinions about him, and he's one of the only comparisons I can think of in sort of a career, and I don't know, I equate you to, if that's okay.
Well, an independent career. He was truly independent. He didn't bow to anybody. I do, because I work for people.
Well, he would probably disagree with that. Yeah. He's not around to do so, but yeah. You know, you're going down the path of video, and I see it as an extension of the same path. I mean, on one end, you're completely docking, interfacing, collaborating artistically, or maybe on some days you're the defense attorney for the artist, you know. And then on the other side, you're mixing your own paints, or you're inventing your own. You're doing what it takes in order to do that.
To get there,
which is a misunderstood position. People misunderstood Ansel Adams. They considered him overly technical. The man tried to take a picture when he was, make a picture, as he would say, when he was 12 years old in Yosemite, and he thought he had made something beautiful. And then they took it to the drugstore, had it developed and printed, and he looked at it and fucking cried. The rest of his life was just trying to achieve that.
I didn't know that.
That about his career. So if he needed to, he needed to come up with his own system to explain something. Is it perfect? He found a way to explain the, you know, basic dynamic range so he could tackle the first issue, which is he has a blown out and a blacked out bullshit picture of the shape of the mountain that he experienced.
And what a dynamic range he got. And that's what occurs to me first in my mind's eye, is that great detail in the blacks and the great detail in the highlights.
I think there were a few things going on that really remind me conceptually of what I think, and you can correct me if I'm missing your concept, but I think of you as resolution-oriented because
there's a... So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that because that's a great subject, because resolution and effective perception of detail, you tend to, when you're talking about resolution, go to technical standards, which don't always have a lot to do with how we resolve detail, especially in immersive.
Which so is this, accutance versus resolution.
And what we're hearing in immersive is that there's a tremendous palette here if we can get details faithfully translated in this immersive space. For instance, there's a guy that does the most amazing records in the world. It's L2 Records out of Oslo. It's Morten Lundgren. And he's an amazing L2 Records. And he does, Ben, you would love this guy. He is partners with the orchestra. He's partners with the writers. It's socialist democracy. He's partners with everybody involved. He's got his own church, and he arranges musicians and singers and performers in the church to speak to a 7-1-4 mic array. He doesn't mix. He doesn't do tight mics. He arranges by moving performers around until it's right. So there's a tremendous amount of rehearsal time. But my God, he's done some records that, you know, there's music that you want to keep listening to, and there's music that you think you should keep listening to. He makes music that you want to keep listening to, and every moment is a reveal of some detail that's just beautiful. He's the cat. So,
if I understand right,
That's not about resolution, although he uses the highest resolution formats and what have you.
Well, you have to organize the resolution or what you've done with the resolution or compromise the resolution in such a way to allow the listener to experience it and to perceive the right thing. So in my opinion, you know, when people do like, you know, let's think of the polar opposite in a way, not polar opposite, they're both artists. They're both going for it. Like they're not evil and good or anything like that. But Ralph Gibson, do you know Ralph Gibson's work? He's a photographer.
No, but I'm right at time.
Ralph Gibson was a 35 millimeter guy, probably 60s and 70s, maybe more like 70s. He's considered his subject and the framing and the piece that he is making for so long what he then does is gives it the highest possible contrast and the highest possible sort of brilliance of grain. The resolution is nothing. There's nothing left of the resolution. It's just black and white, but it's gorgeous. But he has to know before he captures it that he's okay with throwing away everything else in the picture. The opposite to me is Ansel Adams, who did not wish to distort nature based on his perception of it. He was going to capture as much resolution as possible. I mean, who knows what the resolution of an 8x10 negative is?
It's fabulous. It has to be.
It's beautiful.
With good lenses, yeah.
Yeah. And even then, I mean, like, look, if you used one of the lenses that he used, you wouldn't be happy with it now. It would
probably not.
No. You wouldn't be happy with that. But it got it's capturing on in this massive negative. I was watching your display, you're showing a virtual EQ that you've made, and you go into a snare drum. Do you remember doing this?
I hope so.
Okay. Well, look, all you really did, you're just selling your EQ, which is what you need to do.
And it's what I need to do.
Yeah, it's what we do. I sell my EQs all the time. I totally understand. So you went into a snare drum and you're like, you basically turned to the camera and you yelled, bitch, this shit is slapping, but, and then you pulled down, you found two or three peaks.
Yeah.
And they're very, very small slices. And you pulled them up and down to kind of show us all, you know. Now, what I wasn't clear on is why you chose those. And this is all questions about resolution.
This is fantastic because I've grown that presentation for students because they do get carried away with control.
Right.
What the Germans have a word for it, function lust, F-U-N-C-K-T-I-O-N lust. It's about a surgeon with a new scalpel having to use that scalpel. Function lust.
So a
new practitioner with a paramedic glove is going to say, look, I've got a boink. I've got another boink. I've got another boink. Look at, I'll add another EQ. So I've got 10 bands of taking the boink out. It's gone. There's no snare drum left. There's just a cardboard box. And so what I've tried to
because
teach kids how to
because the boink spieler was the guy that you recorded.
Because maybe I didn't ask. I'd be suspicious. But the idea is to make the workflow easier. So you find these boinks in the snare. So it's a close up. And you let it be. And you work through your mix. And as you work through your mix, you add, because the boinks are where the rock and roll comes from.
Right.
That's where the rock and roll comes from.
Right.
Especially that boink off the top of a snare. So you add them back in and you're coloring to fit the mix. And maybe you're taking out the one that conflicts with your main melody in a bridge or something. But you've already identified it. You don't have to stop the session, go back, solo the instrument, and find that thing. My big thing is trying not to solo instruments, especially when the artist is in the room. Don't solo anything. Mm. Let's always focus on the whole performance.
Right.
So it's all about, the mixing is all about, let's get everything up. Okay, everything up. And I've seen Al Schmidt do this. Everything up and then this a little bit down, this a little bit up. And the a little bits get less and less and less until the za moment, the beginning of The Simpsons with the clouds. Za,
yeah,
The
yeah,
Simpsons,
yeah,
yeah. And your mix appears and you haven't ruined anything yet. You haven't compressed the shit out of anything. You haven't EQ'd the shit out of anything. And in the case of the drum, you've got a palette pre-selected to go to and adjust to fit the texture or the integrity of the mix. But that was the theory. So that's what I'm teaching these days. Seems to work.
Yeah, I call it New Week's Resolution, which is just a way of trying to include everyone in resolving that we'll do one thing or think about creativity or do an exercise once a week that is recommended by creative people. And you're a teacher, so I'm sure you must have something there. But like, for instance, once a week, we're all going to read poetry in bed for 5 minutes. Anything that you think might be of use. Do you have an exercise for us?
Well, one thing is when I tell students, I learned this from a guy I worked with when I went to California, Maurice White, is he'd hear a playback.
Maurice White.
And he wouldn't know what to make of it. He was the leader of our
team. Yeah, hell yeah, he was.
And we had our differences. But he would listen to something and he didn't know what to make of it. And he'd say, play it again. Play it again. And he'd listen to it again. And he'd say, play it again. And a couple artists I've worked for, I've seen them do this. James Taylor did this the very first time we tuned, Don Grawlink and I tuned one of his vocals on the record I did with him, the live record. And he listened to it and said, play it again. And he was listening to the whole context.
Mm-hmm.
So my discipline for students is, if you don't know what to say, it's a good time not to say anything.
Right.
Or as Jeff Beccaro used to say, when in doubt, lay out.
Oh, that's great.
I've come into those situations which are less comfortable and more challenging.
Yeah.
Where I really have to think about, I heard somebody explain it, that when we work in this this discipline, I'll still call it. You have to work from your head, your heart, and your guts. And they each could tell a different story.
That's
right. And you're sitting there, you know, behind the big desk with your head, your heart, your guts out there telling you shit. And, you know, the barking, they're responding. You have to figure out what's common to this. The director, at his best, takes all these things into account, makes one call.
Yeah.
It's kind of zen. Just makes one call, and it's the perfect glue between these different disciplines. So that's what I've been trying to do,
that's
is to
balance.
Find that center point. Yeah, balance.
It's a moving target, that balance. Art in itself is just full of so many contradicting forces at once. But the magic of the recording is a new day every single time, right? I mean,
every time, yeah. And it should be. And it's when it isn't that you're in trouble. When you're rubber stamping, and there are a lot of records like that, you know, that are just rubber stamped, cookie cutter.
Elliot Shiner was saying that the thing he misses about, quote, the olden days, is just that it felt like he went to work and had to solve problems all day. That all it was solving problems. And for him, almost as a distraction or an artifact of the day, he could immerse himself in problem solving. The more, I guess, he's come to the self-actualization, ether of that, he has to think about the big things now because many of the little things have solved themselves.
The other thing to remember about Elliot is that he always tells the truth from his heart. Mm. You know, when you're in a group like our group, a part of you wants to talk to Al Schmidt and impress Al. Elliot's not like that at all.
Awesome.
He doesn't give a fuck. And he did the most amazing 5-1 mixes on Yamaha NS10s. Mm. And yeah, I mean, I feel like I've got to give him a lot of shit about it. But they work on anything because he's found that great balance. He's got that feel. Well, these are Genlex. I've been working on these for 20 years. Nico Bolas, if you know Nico Bolas, got on the Skype with me and said, Genlex, what are you, a caveman? Genlex. But I've also got ATCs to mix vocals on. And
I was going to tell you that the first, because I never really got to hear, I've never gotten to hear your work in immersive and, I mean,
okay.
I want to hear it because, see, I came to Blackbird and you showed me the room and you didn't bring up any of your mixes. You brought up the soundtrack to, well, I mean, hell, maybe it was your mix, but it was Kill Bill.
No, I hadn't done any mixes in there yet. That was still 5-1. I started mixing in there when John invested in a 9-1-6 system. So 6 in the air, 9 around you, and 2 great subs. And that's where we brought in Ann Mincelli, who's Alicia's person, and she was floored. And it's just, it's a moment that you recognize through your life, and it has happened to you where you hear something and your DNA shifts. Your DNA just shifts. And that's the rest of your life, is your DNA saying, hey, wait a minute, remember this time. And that room is now the place to listen to immersives. Now, you'll never hear it that way again, I'm afraid. We'd like to think that.
Well, this is the thing about the delivery system of that stuff. I mean, I sat and listened to Elliot's mix of Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah. Okay. Now I get it. I got all the surround stuff in that way because I could tell that there were ways I was inside that mix that I would never be again. I wasn't in the original. And the original sounds like, I don't know. I don't. Yeah.
The original is a pop tune. Original is a pop tune. But in its best reincarnation, multi-channel mix will focus on things that are interesting in a dynamic artistic space, things that can move in space and make sense in space. The later mixes that Eric and I have been doing for Alicia, where, you know, we really have to maintain a groove, but there are things that can move around and there's some swimmy things that can rotate. And it doesn't hurt the groove. If it doesn't hurt the groove, we can do it. But if there's ever an opportunity to go back to that room and listen to there's a Billie Eilish mix that David Leonard made that killed me, and her brother won't let her put it out because he wants to mix it. And that's their choice, but killed me. And a couple of other things. I've done a couple that I'm proud of out of 20 mixes. There are a couple that I think I've nailed, and that's about as good as I ever do. And the artist is happy with the others, so I'm okay. And between David Leonard and a couple of these guys that are working with Immersive, we're starting to do stuff that will have a life beyond the current soundbar under the TV. You know, that's interesting in a snooze kind of way. The Echo Studio, which is not good. And it's a suggestion of, it's a hint at what the future might be, but it's not good.
You know, composers up until the 20th century probably weren't going to hear their work fully realized. And even if they did, they might hear it once or twice. You know, the architects that make amazing buildings that no one will stand in their lifetime, it seems like you may be on the tip of that a little bit, because I should have a system that can deliver what you're making. But if I don't, who besides movies, and I have to tell you, the only time I've ever really listened to the surround mixes in a movie, it was My Music. It was in Nashville, one of those places that has like 20 theaters in it. And I happened to have made a movie that was playing in about 15 of them. So I was disgusted with what I heard so much that I couldn't even watch the movie. And I walked out, popcorn half-eaten, and I realized it was playing in the one next door. So I thought, let me check it out in that one.
Let's try that.
Completely different.
That's right.
Sounded absolutely different. And then I walked from that one to the next one. I was like, well, I don't know who to believe because they all sound different. So even if you have your system, do you need to come tune this for us? I mean, how can we get
exactly
to the place to make this happen?
So this is where Hans Zimmer has really demonstrated the greatest mastery. Because I love Hans. He's a good guy.
It was a movie I did with him, by the way. So
I'm so sorry, because he usually gets it right. That little
it wasn't him. It was the movie theater.
Yeah.
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 I think Alex Meyerson, was that the name of the?
Alan Meyerson. Alan Meyerson. He's good too.
He was the guy who mixed it, and I had liked everything he had done. So I didn't feel like it was him. But like I say, like every theater sounded different. When you're working in a medium where in this very same building you hear in the same room, it was the same room over and over again, I heard four or five mixes.
Yeah. And here's the thing about Hans Zimmer is when it leaves his production company, it's what he imagines it to be. Mm. And he's done this enough so that he can articulate an objective, and he's got a great team, and they just go for it. Nobody's fighting with him. So when it leaves his facility, it's right. When it gets out there, it's in the hands of Amazon. Amazon is one of our big channels. Sony has a thing called RA360, and all they're interested in is binaural. So they take the 714 mix and re-render it to binaural, which means you kind of get a sense of this shit going on. But it's not right, because it's not right. Because to do that, you need to do it very well. And we've heard this. Bob Ludwig and Ellie Shiner and I were at CES in Las Vegas years ago, and we all went into this room where these two British guys, Stephen and Jonathan Smythe, had done this system where they took individual HRTFs. You know, so you look here,
right.
You take six runs, you look here, you take six runs, you look here, you take six runs, you have a head tracker, and then they put mics in your ears and they calibrate them. They do a complete set of HRTFs, head-related transfer functions, from all these different angles. And we were blown away.
Mm.
So these guys aren't really productizers. So they built a system that was $4,000 in hi-fi stores, and you can imagine how well they've done. Not very well.
Wow.
So this idea of making common HRTFs is something that we're still working on. We've got a couple guys in video games, because one of the big video games companies, we provide lambs to the slaughter in the video games, the engineers. And a couple of other guys that are working on how to do this right, and it's still formative. However, we know that we've got the original. We've got the 714, the 916, whatever, and it's fucking great. just render it well.
Yeah. Got to get it in the hands of the people.
You know, having no ability to craft lyrics and a great love of artists like you who can craft the most beautiful lyrics and capture people's hearts, is I'm thinking, is my most passionate dream too subtle to share?
Mm.
And a lot of times you have a dream and it's, and you have dreams. I mean, the whole Firefly concept, beautiful sense of possibilities. Is the ability to get away from the abstraction and to make it shareable, that the great artist makes it shareable.
Thanks so much for the time. It's just so good to see you, man. You look awesome.
Thank you so much. There are so few people in the world that I could glean this much pleasure out of in a conversation.
Oh, man.
It's always,
I feel
always, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care.
Hi, if you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot.